This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And behold the shepherd tone. A sound illusion, always sliding upward or downward, yet never quite disappearing, like the red and blue stripes on a barber's pole. As this sonic mass moves up and up and up, the tension rises also until nothing. No resolution, no catharsis. Here comes another rising line, and another after that. Around the office here, we've come to see this up and up and up of the Trump era, especially when it comes to Russia and the Mueller investigation, as its own shepherd tone. Some slip of the tongue or unsealed indictment seems to herald a resolution that never arrives. As Saturday Night Live memorably spoofed after Trump casually confessed to obstruction of justice on network TV.
Wait, so did I get him? Is this all over? Oh, no, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
100 years ago, by which I mean Monday, the soundtrack of the American media was the shepherd tone, the sound of dissolution and possibly deliverance on an infinitely receding horizon.
You have been watching perhaps one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president at a summit in front of a Russian leader. Only that I've ever seen.
We are living in a national emergency. We may not have known it 24 hours ago. We do now.
What you're hearing is, you're the puppet.
The UK's Guardian quotes critics calling the meeting, quote, nothing short of treasonous. And France's Le Monde writes, Trump is Putin's best ally.
I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
Strong and powerful. That, of course, appears to be what the president admires the most.
This was the time and the place for the president to look Putin squarely in the eye and said, you will be punished for what you did in 2016 and don't ever think about doing that again.
But he didn't. And that's what made it disgusting. That's what made his performance disgusting. I'm sorry, this is the only way I feel.
He is guilty of violating his oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution.
I would say that his performance today will live in infamy as much as the Pearl Harbor attack or Kristallnacht.
But as they lifted their eyes to the mountains seeking help, the old war raged unabated, unchanged.
You have just witnessed the single worst 24 hours in the history of your mainstream media. And according to the abusively biased press, well, the sky is literally falling.
Now it's a major public relations coup for Vladimir Putin. The president sold out this country. It's unbelievable.
That was basically the primetime lineup and the daytime lineups of CNN and MSNBC.
So Donald lost the crazy pants vote. So what? The world is Donkey Kong, and we're always stuck at the same level, especially with Russia.
Cue the 8-bit shepherd tone. As the barber pole of dread revolves, each stripe a lash, seeming to vanish but always seamlessly renewed, he withdraws a word, thus rendering everything else he uttered out of context or nonsensical. And those who can truly check him choose to check out. They have reasons. This week, House Republicans voted down a Democratic effort to increase election security spending. It passed a resolution denouncing the idea of carbon taxes and voted to tighten work requirements for food stamps. We may have missed that newsreel because the executive branch IMAX screens some amazing coming attractions. Here's Andrea Mitchell with the current director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, in Aspen on Thursday.
We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again.
Vladimir Putin coming to the...
Did I hear you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Ultimately, if you want to change the president's behavior or that of this Congress, you can't. The truth is, you can only marshal your own resources and change your own behavior. We saw just a smidge of that this week in the press corps. Even if this week's coverage left us with nothing new about the administration, in the White House press room, close observers accustomed to seeing the assembled step on and over each other saw this.
So when he sees that he's misspoken, he comes out and he says that. Jordan.
Just to follow up on my second question, Sarah. You told Josh the president has been
once again, Hallie, I'm moving on to Jordan. Jordan, go ahead.
Hallie, go ahead if you want.
Thanks, Jordan. You said to
actually,
Josh,
I'm going to take a question from Jordan.
It was just a second or two out of a week that lasted centuries. Just one blip in the spiraling trap of the shepherd tone. But there is a way to break out, to change the nation's perceptions and your own.
There have to be ways to debate ideas to make unacceptable things become acceptable or we'll be stuck.
Up next, this is On the Media.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Trump derangement syndrome, that's what the president calls it, defined by Urban Dictionary as the condition in which a person has been driven effectively insane by dislike of Donald Trump. It derives from Bush derangement syndrome, coined by the late Charles Krauthammer as the acute onset of paranoia in otherwise normal people in reaction to the policies, the presidency, nay, the very existence of George W. Bush. For half the nation, that felt like a perpetual migraine. This feels more like passing a kidney stone, the size of Gibraltar. Surely, if conservatives feel disenfranchised, so do the left as the center continues on its glide path to the right. After all, it was Richard Nixon who created the EPA and made affirmative action federal policy. Ronald Reagan who granted amnesty to 3 million undocumented workers. George H.W. Bush who brushed aside the GOP to forge a budget reconciliation plan with the Democrats. And George W. Bush, well, he did launch an initiative to fight AIDS in Africa that saved millions of lives. That's inconceivable now. Yesterday's centrism is today's no way extremism. Think of the political spectrum as a color wheel. Spun one way, a range of red hues appear in the window and the blue passes out of view. Or just think of it as a window. Call it the Overton window, where you see only the policy options that are currently accepted or attainable.
Joseph P. Overton is a famous conservative from Michigan, and the political science idea that is named for him is called the Overton window.
Rachel Maddow was on it 3 years ago.
The idea of the Overton window is that there's a fairly narrow window of proposals in any particular policy area that people will take seriously, that won't get you written off as a kook. The way to move or expand that window is to advocate super extreme positions, which change the realm of what's politically possible, because after something super nuts has been floated, thereafter, slightly less nuts positions will start to look acceptable and moderate by comparison.
In other words, to recalibrate the center, offset the debate with infeasible extremes.
I think that's one of the misunderstandings of the Overton window. It's not a negotiating technique. It's a model that describes how ideas and policies change. This is what happens when you have an idea and you release it into the wild. It's not your idea anymore.
Joseph Lehman is the president of the Libertarian Mackinac Center for Public Policy, where Overton first posited his window.
Journalists or pundits sometimes treat the Overton window as if it is a tool designed for the purpose of manipulation. And that's not what it's for. It's like saying gravity is for the purpose of dropping pianos on people's heads. Well, you can do that, but you wouldn't want to.
He says society places limits on acceptable ideas, and the Overton window simply clarifies which are acceptable and which less so on a sliding scale.
And they don't change just randomly. They can be changed intentionally. So there have to be ways to debate ideas to make unacceptable things become acceptable or will be stuck.
He says the Overton window was intended not for politicians or activists, but for think tanks and the people who fund them, especially the people who fund them.
The Overton window idea was born out of need. We were trying to raise money, and it was hard to help donors understand how it was that a think tank would make any difference in the world. People donate to lawmakers they like, but think tanks don't have a vote in the legislature. So we had to have a way of explaining that there's more to a piece of legislation than just the day of the vote. And so Joe Overton came up with this idea that he called the window of political possibility. He never called it the Overton window.
Mm-hmm.
That came later, shortly after he was tragically killed in 2003. We thought, well, you know, we can take this idea that Joe began developing and let's name it for him.
It sounds like it was developed initially as a kind of explanatory / public relations notion.
You're absolutely right. So we said, look, at that time in Michigan, there was no school choice at all. Your kid simply went to the school the government assigned him or her to. We didn't have charter schools in the early days. There were no magnet schools. There was no going to a neighboring school district. Your only option was to pull the kid out and pay tuition at a private school. So how can we get from where we were to where we needed to be? If a politician would have proposed, hey, let's have a universal voucher, that politician might have found himself unelected. Anytime ideas move from society and into law, they don't change just randomly. They can be changed intentionally. And that is the work of think tanks.
On Mackinac's website, the Overton window is superimposed on a list of education policies and proposals on a libertarian freedom spectrum. At the top, no government schools. At the bottom, compulsory indoctrination. Inside the Overton window of realistic policy options lay public school choice. Just outside the window, towards what Mackinac deems more freedom, tuition vouchers and less regulated homeschooling. Eventually, Michigan got those and more.
Joe observed that politicians have to operate within a narrow range of policy options. Lawmakers usually are merely ratifying what the public has already decided that it wants. Think of it like a football field. If you only looked at the last 5 yards leading up to the goal line, that's where the legislature does all its work. And the ball would go across the goal line and points would go on the board. And, you know, whoever was responsible for that would get the glory. But what you don't see is how that play gets set up. And that happens further up the field. That is where think tanks have their most influence.
Well, they have been very successful. When I wrote the piece a couple of years ago, we gave some examples of how Overton actually moved the window on some of the policy areas he worked on.
Laura Marsh writes for The New Republic.
he proposed privatizing prisons. And a few years later, Michigan has its first privatized prisons. He worked on what he termed school choice and homeschooling, and that was expanded in Michigan.
Can you attribute those successes to Overton?
Well, certainly Michigan is seen as a kind of bellwether state for a lot of these issues, a place where, you know, Betsy DeVos is very active in Michigan politics, and she's a big advocate for school choice. So, you know, I think it would be kind of absurd to say that Joseph Overton achieved this all by himself. But I think that willingness to propose more radical policies aligns with the politics of the state and is part of a kind of bigger ecosystem in which those changes happened.
America and its media love politics. The stakes, the psychodrama, the conspiracies where shadowy figures maneuver in the margins and slip in and out of windows, especially now in the face of something like lunacy front and center. So the Overton window is trending.
He is what we call opening the Overton window. This is a political theory where it's becoming more and more acceptable to talk about things that used to be publicly off limits.
Because he's moved the Overton window to so far to the right and so far to into an insane asylum that we now are rooting for Bob Corker.
I do wonder if it does have this weird Overton window effect where like Ted Cruz seems like, he's a sort of stand-up guy and he's not Donald Trump.
In doing my research on what's happening in America and also for my new thriller, The Overton Window, I came across the ingredients that they put in the political process called the Overton Window Theory. Now, you may not know it by name, but you have had it used on you over and over again.
That was Glenn Beck back in 2010 on his new thriller in a genre he dubbed faction, completely fictional books with plots rooted in fact. His plot involved a messianic PR guy scheming to root out and replace democracy with a ruling class of self-appointed ubermenschen. His mad method, indoctrination via the Overton window, making the unacceptable first palatable and then inevitable. Lehman says Beck's book got the concept wrong. It's not a manipulation. But Beck and his book still feature prominently on the Mackinac website because, heck, publicity. This excerpt is read by the anti-Beck Bob Garfield.
Use airline security as an example, Noah said. 40 years ago, people could pull up to the airport a few minutes before their flight, be treated with courtesy and respect, present no ID, just a ticket, and then get on the plane with just about anything in their pockets and their bags. Today, that's unthinkable, right? She nodded. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, let's make the passengers arrive 4 hours early for the security line, allow no carry-ons, enforce a mandatory strip search, full body x-ray, a cavity probe for everyone, and you have to stay in the seat the entire flight with a stun bracelet on your wrist in case you try to get up to go to the bathroom, which of course no longer exists. They're actually talking about doing some of those things, she said. That's getting to my point. If you suddenly had to go through everything I just mentioned, you'd give up flying, correct? So your Overton window is somewhere in the middle, within this box. We put a false extreme at both ends to make the choices in the middle look moderate, and then, with a little nudge, you can be made to agree to something you would have never swallowed last week.
The Tea Party is often seen as a group that used the Overton window pretty effectively. They're an insurgent group who pulled their party toward their political views. Glenn Beck was a prominent kind of advocate for the Tea Party. So it's not exactly clear whether he doesn't like that kind of activist strategy. It felt to me more like he just worried that that could be hijacked by people on the left who had different political leanings from him.
There was a huge upset in the Democratic primary last night here in New York. Longtime incumbent Joe Crowley, the fourth-ranking congressional Democrat, suffered a stunning defeat at the hands of first-time candidate Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is only 28 years old.
And many are hailing Cortez as a rising star on the political landscape. But in reality, her policy positions are actually downright scary. This is your modern Democratic Party. Government subsidized housing for everybody, tuition, free colleges. She wants to abolish ICE and, of course, impeach President Trump.
Ocasio-Cortez did denounce capitalism. She uses the lingo of the far left and Marxists, the kind of stuff you hear at, you know, Thursday night seminars at university.
Yeah, people have written a lot about how she's moved the Overton window to the left. She ran on policies like abolish ICE, Medicare for all. And with her victory in the primary, other politicians in the Democratic Party have come out and adopted those positions or been more open about their support for them. I think that what we're seeing now is for the first time people on the left actually using Overton window consciously as a strategy, talking about it, trying to influence politics in the Democratic Party by consciously shifting where the sort of center of acceptable opinion is.
We should protect families that need our help, and that is not what ICE is doing today, and that's why I believe you should get rid of it, start over, and build something that actually works.
We should abolish ICE. We should create something better, something different.
I think there's no question that we've got to critically re-examine ICE and its role and the way that it is being administered and the work it is doing, and we need to probably think about starting from scratch.
They saw that some of the failures of the Democratic Party in the 2016 election were often about staying timidly within this consensus, even when the base actually might like to go further left and look at more progressive policies. So they've been a lot more bold about striking out with much more daring statements of those policies. One of the main reasons that the Overton window keeps getting used is that one of the activists and writers who was talking about abolish ICE particularly really adopted that term very enthusiastically, Sean McAlwey, whose name on Twitter is Overton Window Mover.
I think that moving the Overton window involves simply introducing ideas into the public with a clear, coherent vision and getting people excited about those ideas and interested in those ideas.
Writer and activist Sean McAlwey.
And it turns out that when you introduce people to the idea of abolishing a fascist agency dedicated to ethnic cleansing, it's actually quite popular.
McAlwey clearly does not shy away from extreme progressive formulations outside the Overton window. He just wants those extreme positions to pull the window to the left, whereas now, he says, it's monopolized by the right.
So a great example is the recent sort of immigration debates that happened in Congress, which was you had this instance in which this Representative Goodlatte introduced a very, very extreme right-wing bill. And then you had this moderate, in finger quotes, part of the Republican caucus introduce their proposal. And then this was referred to in most media outlets as a, quote, compromise bill. But of course, no Democrats supported the compromise bill.
Sometimes you all repeat it, that it's a compromise, but it is not a compromise.
Nancy Pelosi.
It may be a compromise with the devil, but it's not a compromise with the Democrats.
It was a compromise within the Republican caucus. So I imagine a world in which Primula Jayapal and Mark Pocan introduced legislation to abolish ICE and pay reparations to detainees, and then some more centrist members of the Democratic Conference introduce a bill that says what we should really do is dramatically rein in ICE, investigate human rights abuses, and introduce a comprehensive path to citizenship. And that is referred to as a compromise bill. As soon as abolish ICE becomes a mainstream position within the Democratic Party, I am going to argue that we should abolish ICE and pay reparations to detainees and also decriminalize migration. And, you know, when that becomes a centrist proposal, you know, I'll think of something even more left-wing.
Ah, so you are really talking about the Overton window. You're talking about going for asks that you don't anticipate you'll get anytime soon, like reparations, in order to make less radical positions that are still far to the left of what has now become the norm more palatable.
Exactly. The one thing I would add, though, if I may note the limitations of the idea, is that it is not a substitute for doing work. At the end of the day, abolish ICE had to become something that people showed up to protests holding signs in favor of. Like, you have to have a movement behind it. Because if you don't have people yelling in the streets, people won't take it seriously. I think there's just a temptation among people who solely understand politics through Twitter of believing that they're doing radical social action by saying something extreme. But the reality is that to the extent that the movement gains power, it comes from people who are organized. So the Overton Window is a tool, but it has to be used in concert with indirect action to be powerful.
You said politicians don't move the window, but what do you think about Trump?
I'm surprised it took until now for you to ask.
Joseph Lehman of the Mackinac Center.
I think sometimes the tail can wag the dog. You can get a truly transformational figure who is a leader in the fullest sense of the word. And I have no idea if Trump is that kind of person. He's a very odd political character, as everyone knows by now. And I wouldn't want people to try to describe Trump's actions as an attempt to shift the window, because I don't know if that's what he's trying to do.
So his questioning NATO, his questioning free trade, his embrace of Duterte and Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin, and his disparagement of the EU, not to mention all the racist stuff. This isn't moving the window on acceptable discourse?
Yeah, I think he's good at revealing things that people didn't realize were there before. I'll tell you what, I'd spend a lot of time thinking about the Overton window, and I don't spend any time thinking about whether Donald Trump is shifting it or not, because even if he is, it's just not a very clean example.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much more going on with him. He's just so unconventional. He defies categorization. He's got the ability to light all of his detractors' hair on fire simultaneously. What does that do to the Overton window? I have no idea, but it creates a lot of noise, and then he seems to have learned how to capitalize on that.
And he does, pouring more diesel fuel with every escalating outrage. Trump and his constituents, as seen in his media and poll numbers, relish the wailing of his foes. Who wouldn't? We began this segment with derangement, so let's end it there. Apparently, Einstein did not say that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. According to the website Professor Buzzkill, the definition of insanity, quote, first appeared in 1981 in a pamphlet published by Narcotics Anonymous. Insanity, it said, is repeating the same mistakes and expecting different results. Crying, oh, the humanity, is not a strategy. It's an addiction. It leaves a person sticky and spent and adrift in the rag and bone shop bus station bathroom of the soul. There is a window out of there, formerly called the window of political possibility. For the once blissfully complacent hair on fire crowd, it's currently out of range. It took 30 years of careful planning, heaps of money, and the diligence of think tanks for the right to claim it. But the window scuds on the political wind, and the current occupants don't have a lease. Coming up, 30 years after Congress discovered global warming, one veteran environmental reporter wishes he'd talk to a shrink about the national psyche.
I've come to see the emergence of global warming as a symptom of a much more profound juncture in human history. We're emerging as a species that just drifted along for most of its existence, mostly at the whims of nature. With fossil fuels, you know, the last 200 years, we went from a billion people to 7.7 billion or so, all seeking middle-class lives.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Some things in the world happen shockingly fast, others imperceptibly slowly. As we heard, the tug of war over perceptions is waged over generations. 30 years ago this summer, NASA climate scientist James Hansen testified before the Senate, warning that global warming was real and that he was, quote, 99% certain that the warming trend was caused by humans. He displayed a chart of rising temperatures.
And 1988, so far, is so much warmer than 1987 that barring a remarkable and improbable cooling, 1988 will be the warmest year on the record. This evidence represents a very strong case, in my opinion, that the greenhouse effect has been detected and it is changing our climate now.
It's often cited as the moment, or at least the season, when the gravity of the science became front page news. The Times, putting the story on A1, ran the headline, "Global warming has begun, expert tells Senate." Just below that story was another one, "Drought raising food prices." That's because the country was under a months-long drought and heat wave that summer. And officials estimate that between 5 and 10,000 people in the U.S. died from the high temperatures.
The barren spots in the mountains, the parched fields of the Midwest, the soaring temperatures throughout the country, all finally have got people believing in what once seemed science fiction, the greenhouse effect.
The mercury topped 100 again today on the scorched fields of Wisconsin, deepening the drought and forcing farmers to feed their cows from winter reserves.
The summer of 88 is a scorcher, but not a fluke. The 80s have brought us the 4 hottest years in the last 100, and don't look for quick relief.
1988 is also the year that Andrew Revkin first started on the global warming beat. He'd go on to cover the story for the New York Times, but in October of 1988, he wrote a cover story for Discover magazine, "Endless Summer, Living with the Greenhouse Effect." Andy Revkin is now strategic advisor for environmental and science journalism at the National Geographic Society. His piece, Looking Back at 1988, is called Climate, The More Things Change, and it's in the July issue of National Geographic magazine. Andy, welcome back to the show.
It's a little bit like Groundhog Day, but it's still great to be back with you.
I described the 1988 heat wave in the introduction, but what was so significant about Hansen's testimony?
You know, he was making the point there that unlike the pollution that we did a great job cleaning up starting in the 60s and 70s here, the smoggy stuff, carbon dioxide, heat-trapping gas, when you release it into the atmosphere, it stays there. It might go into a tree for 100 years, and then it comes back out. Mm-hmm. And so it builds like unpaid credit card debt. It's a cumulative problem. That was the point he was trying to make. If you don't get at it early, it just compounds.
1988 was the year that the globe was at 350 carbon dioxide parts per million, a significant number.
Yeah, Hansen went on to write a paper with some colleagues positing that if you build beyond that, you're in the hot zone, you're in the danger zone, and it keeps building. And that figure, of course, inspired Bill McKibben, his book, The End of Nature, mm-hmm. which was really the first popular book on global warming, came out the following year.
350, and we're past it. Where are we now?
410 or so.
We have some tape from a CBS News report from 1980 when we were at 339 parts per million. So this is 8 years before you got on the beat, 8 years before Hansen testified.
The relatively small amounts of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere filter the warming rays of the sun to the Earth's surface. But like a greenhouse, carbon dioxide also prevents heat given off by the Earth from escaping into space. Fossil fuels, when burned, release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Coal, the worst culprit, oil and natural gas to lesser degrees. Scientists and a few politicians are beginning to worry that ice caps could melt, raising the level of the seas.
But if it happens, it means goodbye Miami, goodbye Corpus Christi, goodbye Sacramento, goodbye Boston.
That seems so long ago. If you'd said that was a report from 1936 or something, I would believe it.
Well, the first article that really nailed this was a Popular Science article in 1912, and it basically said, hey, we're burning billions of tons of coal. It's going to warm the climate. It's going to change things for centuries.
You've said that the big mistake you made in the early coverage of this story is that you saw it as a kind of a pollution problem.
Well, it just gives it a template. It's the existing narrative. In other words, we need to cut emissions by 20%. Let's have a treaty or a law, and we'll magically do that. There was a growing thought about having a price on carbon, and the problem there, too, is that the price would have to be so high to change the behavior of industries and individuals that no one could figure out politically how you could possibly do that, not just here, but everywhere. Another reason everyone thought that we could do this is because in 1987, there was the Montreal Protocol, and that was a treaty to cut chlorofluorocarbons, a different kind of compound, eroding the ozone layer.
Each spring, over Antarctica, a hole in the ozone develops. To date, as much as 50 to 60% of the ozone in this area has been lost. These discoveries prompted a coordinated series of Antarctic ozone experiments.
Scientists had demonstrated that if we ignored that, that could be a deadly consequence for us and for many species. So everyone thought, look, hey, we did it. We had this huge treaty on a chemical with a long-lived effect. Ergo, we can do it with CO2 too. Again, that shaped how the coverage was framed. It shaped how environmentalists framed their actions. It shaped the way legislation was proposed. And it all kept running up against the reality that's reflected in the fact that we still are 85% a fossil-fueled world, not just here, but everywhere.
What's the feeling you had in revisiting your 30 years of coverage? What is the lesson that you draw?
I've come to see the emergence of global warming as a symptom of a much more profound juncture in human history. We're emerging as a species that just drifted along for most of its existence, mostly at the whims of nature. With fossil fuels, you know, the last 200 years, we went from a billion people to 7.7 billion or so, all seeking middle-class lives. There's an emergent aspect of that that makes it different than a problem that you fix. It took time to get into this mess, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, getting into this mess has pulled hundreds of millions of people out of poverty.
Bingo. That's the paradox. CO2 is essentially, for the moment, a proxy for progress. And the one thing I started writing about in the Times a lot in 2006 was the utter disinvestment we have made in R&D. If you really want a post-carbon society that's prosperous for everyone, without the underpinning of basic science, you don't get there from here.
But you have leadership in Washington that's still calling for the use of coal, which employs so few people and offers no future.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes from this sort of cultural slash tribal nature of society right now. Last year, Bill McKibben wrote a piece in the New Republic calling for a war on climate change. I've looked back, you know, the war on poverty began in 1964, the war on cancer, Richard Nixon, 1971.
War on drugs, that one's been really
good. Well, right. And so it's fine to call these things wars if you want, but global warming is the ultimate example of something that we think is one thing, but is so much bigger. And I quoted Timothy Morton as a sort of a philosopher and a student of language at Rice University, and he has this word called hyper-objects. Hyper-objects are things that you'd think are one thing and they're another. And he, in this piece he did in High Country News in 2008, none of which I'd really seen until I was probing at this question of why we get this wrong, he compared it to the scene in Empire Strikes Back where Han Solo flies the Millennium Falcon into what he thinks is a cave on an asteroid to get away from the enemy. And there's earthquakes and things are starting to happen, and as they're zooming out of the cave, it turns out it's the mouth of a giant worm.
I see it.
What is the frame that you think is getting in the way of telling the story the way it should be told?
First, you know, it was the idea it was a pollution problem. You do what we did with the other ones. Then it was a political problem, for sure. I did a piece when I was at ProPublica where I ran the numbers on whether Hillary or Trump presidency would make much of a difference in the long process of global warming. And we're such a small part of the global emissions pie, and it really was a tiny differential. If you look at it in terms of this accumulating gas in the atmosphere, we have been by far the dominant source of the gas that's built up in the atmosphere so far. China's coming up quickly. But when you look forward, nearly all the growth comes from emissions in developing countries, just like I wrote in 1988. There are 750 million people in India living in households that are cooking on wood or dung and dying young, and they could use propane. And for someone to say they shouldn't have that because of a global concern about global warming is utterly unethical, at least from my standpoint.
Can you summarize the mistakes the media made that you made? in the coverage?
What I regret most is what emerged for me in 2006. So after An Inconvenient Truth came out, Al Gore's movie, and that's when the rhetoric really got hot and the fighting got intense. And an editor said, hey, Andy, why don't you do a piece for a Week in Review on what the hell's going on here? Why are we all so angry about this? That was the first time in, at that point, 18 years of journalism on global warming that I interviewed a sociologist and a psychologist. That was my real oh no moment.
Why? What did he tell you, or she?
I was asking Helen Ingram at UC Irvine what gets people to vote on things. And she said, well, people vote on things that are soon, salient, and certain. As she's saying these words, I'm going, oh my God, that's not global warming. And then I started talking to more people in the social and behavioral sciences, Robert Brule at Drexel and Dan Kahane at the Yale Law School. And he was doing all this work that showed that basic literacy on climate science is not an indicator of your concern about climate change. The reason we get into these boxes when an issue gets polarized, and this is not just climate change, it's vaccines and nuclear power, is because your affiliation with your tribe, historically, evolutionarily, is more valuable to you than facts. If your part of this landscape is advancing renewable energy, and you go into Woodward County, Oklahoma, which Yale identified as the most skeptical county in America on global warming, John Sutter, this really great CNN journalist, went to Woodward County, Oklahoma in 2015, and he interviewed a guy who's like your classic oil patch guy, you know, blue shirt and a tie. And at one point he says, well, you know, God controls the environment.
When he said in Genesis, be good stewards of this land and take care of it, that has value always.
And then he says, you know, I've got half my roof covered with solar panels and we want to get off the grid entirely.
We're going to try to have a solar system big enough to supply all the needs of our house.
It seems like cognitive dissonance, but then you realize the reason he wants to get off the grid is the same reason he would never vote for a Democrat. If you think that the barrier to having a conversation with him that will benefit climate policy is his belief on global warming, and you try to defeat him or something, you're missing that. This cultural cognition work and the other psychological studies show that there's always something you can find in somebody that is in alignment with what you think as well. The idea that you can change their views by battering them with facts is pretty much fantasy.
I want to get back to uncertainty and salience and short term. We have a commentary from John Chancellor of NBC from the summer of 1988, where he seems to be presenting the issue with all of those things. He did this in the aftermath of James Hansen's Capitol Hill testimony.
Energy which doesn't pollute is expensive, but look at this week's cost of a hotter planet. Workers walking off the job, farmers going broke, food prices rising, water rationed, the Mississippi River closed. In the long run, clean energy is cheaper. What's frustrating is that the humans who are part of the problem also know the solution. It isn't a scientific problem, it's political and financial. And it's also all that boring business about cleaning up pollution. Hard to keep our minds on that in this heat, but if we don't keep our minds on that, the heat will only get worse. Which is commentary for this evening, Tom.
Thank you, John. There is some good news tonight for people who love to eat chocolate.
That's great. I love the transition.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There you go. One of the other things I learned from sociologists, I think it was Elke Weber, who was at Columbia at the time. She says we all have a finite basket of worry that we walk around with.
Mm-hmm.
It's always the thing about your kids or healthcare for sure, and the paycheck stuff. And then there's this thing called global warming. And then there's chocolate and your diet. If you're too climate-centric, which of course I have been, you can miss those contexts that really do determine more about what we do and don't do. It's like, can we hold two thoughts in our head at the same time? One thing I've been writing for a long time, not just in the context of global warming, it started with a really early post on my daughter's blog at the Times. Are we stuck with blah, 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 bang?
Translate that.
Well, you know, whether it's earthquake risk in Istanbul, which I wrote about, or it's global warming, or it's even asteroids like the one over Siberia a few years ago, you know, where we know it's there, the evidence is clear, we don't act.
You have said before that you are a recovering denialist, which doesn't mean that you're denying global warming. Your denial lies in your, quote, longstanding presumption, like that of many scientists and journalists, that better communication of information will tend to change people's perceptions, priorities, and behavior. You wrote that in 2011 when we were at 391 carbon dioxide parts per million. If better communication doesn't tend to change people's minds and behavior, what are you even doing?
Oh, well, all right, I'll break that down. I guess the two things that I began to appreciate that I hadn't fully appreciated are those cognitive and sociological realities, and also that the more I spent time in developing countries, and I'd been, you know, in the Amazon rainforest and poor households in 89, but really in the to the last decade or two, when I was in Nairobi, where 400,000 people, even in the middle of Nairobi, had hardly any electricity or clean water, or when I was in India for ProPublica and looking in at this cooking pollution issue, seeing women having to spend a couple hours to go down the road to collect sticks just to do the bath water for their family for the evening, not just including the separate fuel collecting they do for cooking. You know, I realized that when so many times I had written or spoken the words, we need to, mm-hmm. I look around the world and realize when it comes to energy, there's no we. If you're in India, that's a primary imperative. And that's why India, they're pushing hard on solar, but they're also saying we're going to use a lot more coal. So all of that together has gotten me to think about this a little bit more like, well, you think, well, what are the other big things that we work on that we know we can't solve? And one of them is just basically living a good life. You know you're going to die. And with global warming, you know now that it's more of a journey than a fixable problem.
So we're going to die, and ultimately the Earth will die. And then to quote Woody Allen's character in Annie Hall, the universe is expanding, so why bother doing your homework?
Of course, you pursue things energetically that you think matter. And whatever your skill set is, whether you're a student or an entrepreneur or a teacher or an investor or a journalist, you find your place in that. You know, you work on it. When a problem is this big, everyone can play a role, but it doesn't fit our standard template for how we move forward in society. It's not like a piece of legislation or a widget. It's an attitude. And there are these basic needs that really are emerging now. They're for the first time. And there's great data journalism happening, you know, imposing transparency, whether it's on deforestation that's illegal, who's building how many power plants, wherever, you know, is there lying in the treaty process? You can truth that. And that's why I wake up in the morning not bummed out. You know, I think there's tons that can be done, but it does get away from this frame word that I used to hate. We're in the early days of that, and I think it's a wonderful time.
I think that what happens in the face of deep uncertainty is that people create panel discussions. I don't know if anything beyond that actually happens.
Blah, 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 bang. But you can have a conversation like that one in Woodward County, Oklahoma, with someone who will never embrace global warming as an existential threat, but who loves solar energy. Mm-hmm. You can find a way to have that conversation at each level and defeat this polarized politics, find room for agreement. It is incremental. It's not the old model of fixing a problem. And it will lead to a world that's profoundly different than the one you and I grew up in the 20th century. Walter Cronkite just saying, that's the way it is. You know, we don't know where this journey is going to end up, but we do know there's plenty to do, and that keeps me going.
Andy Revkin is now Strategic Advisor for Environmental Science Journalism at the National Geographic Society. He's also co-author of Weather, an Illustrated History from Cloud Atlases to Climate Change. that's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Lowinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Yasmin Khan. We had more help from Meg Harney. And special thanks to Robert Brule. Our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And if you're looking for more On the Media on a regular basis, you can follow us on Facebook, where our voracious producers are always posting what they're reading and watching and listening to. And that includes material that shapes the show as the week goes on. And if you're missing us midweek, every Wednesday we have a little extra program for you on our podcast feed. You can follow us on Twitter for commentary and important links throughout the week. You can see photos of our office and of our show mascot, Jesse the Fish, on our Instagram account. That's at On the Media, too. And last but not least, go to onthemedia.org/newsletter to sign up for the most delightful thing you could get in your inbox on Thursday mornings. It's the unfiltered id of our producers, and it sure is weird.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.